Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
Pod date 2014.71. The Podship RCR Segment 8 continues its journey through the retroverse, searching for ancient technologies and glories of bygone days.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know. Will I ever find my way back to Oz?
Welcome to another episode of the Retro Computing Roundtable. The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, and collecting. I am Michael Mulhern from Podfleet Academy, your captain for this mission to explore the retroverse. With me on the command deck is First Officer Evans.
Aye, sir.
Science Officer Vanston.
Check out my ears.
And hiding down in the engine room, Chief Engineer Hagstrom.
We cannot go any faster.
Did we bring the doctor?
No, the doctor is conspicuously absent. He wouldn't get in the transporter.
The Daleks must have got him. Oops, sorry. wrong retro stream.
You just jumped the tracks, man. We'll have to exterminate you.
Well, good morning and good afternoon and whatever time zone you're in, and welcome to the RCR.
So we were all doing a Blake 7 thing there, right?
Exactly.
Okay, down just so I'm following.
Okay.
Come on, get
with
the program, Mr. C.
Well, he is the science officer. He has to explore all theories.
That's what I call them, theories.
Okay. Well, it's been a while since we've all been together, so welcome back, Earl. Welcome back, Carrington. I hope that your endeavors on the last fortnight were successful, or at least you've survived, it would appear.
Earl has been released on his own recognizance.
Yes, they finally let me out. And I wanted to say, you guys did great on that show. Way to go. It was fun listening to it. Mm-hmm. It was like, wait a minute, you know, I can tune in and hear some good retro goodness. And I didn't even have to do any work. That was awesome.
Well, thank you very much. I'm sure that we should give all the credit to Paul, who went into the captain's chair himself last week. So it's good to see.
Nah, I don't know. But yeah, it was fun to do, but it's great to have you back. It's a little strange somehow having no founding members
well, we've made up for it for this week.
It was odd for me editing because I kept waiting for me to contribute. I was like, nope, I guess I had nothing to say again.
Well, it was like that show before last, which I wasn't able to make, and the topic was, when did you first get into retro computers at, and it was basically at school, and for me it would have definitely been crickets chirping, because I didn't even get to touch the computers until I was actually at university, so that one I would have been attending, but conspicuously quiet. But that's not our host topic for today. In the news, XP is about to go away. Well, at least its security updates are going to go away, which got me thinking. Here we have possibly still a mainstream operating system that's going to have its 12th birthday. And on April 8th, your XP-powered PC is about to go out of support. Now, some people think that the retroness rule of thumb is 10 years or older, but would we really consider XP to be a retro operating system? Also to think, Windows 95 is going to be 20 years old next year. Is that retro? And Windows NT 3.1 was actually released in July 1993. Would we consider NT a retro operating system? It's already 20 years old. So guys, what do you think? Are software and operating systems treated differently in their retroness compared to hardware? Or do we have some other way of determining what is retro? Is it a sliding scale? Is it by eras?
I suppose I could jump in on this. I gave this a little bit of thought ahead of the show, and it seemed to me like I don't think this is just me, but I don't think I'm ever going to be able to think that Windows XP is retro, or at least not in the sort of same kind of way that I think about, you know, the TRS-80s and the Apple IIs and the PDPs and things. And I'm not sure exactly where the cutoff point is, but I guess it just seems like things got so much more complex that anything in like 2000 or beyond, it doesn't seem to have, I don't know, it seems like a different kind of thing. I kind of wonder if people of the future will you know, sort of go back and try to get systems of, you know, 2010 running again for any reason other than, you know, to play some game they remember from the past. It doesn't feel like there's the same kind of, I don't know, ability to explore. I don't know. I'm not sure exactly what makes me think this, but I definitely think that there's something kind of constant about the like 1970 to 90 time that isn't going to, you know, that's not a sliding window. The 2000s are not going to be the new 1980s in 2034.
No, I'd have to agree with you there. I've kind of feel that you've got the 60s, 70s, the 80s by themselves, the 90s by themselves, and then everything after 2000 really just seems to be evolutionary. It doesn't seem to be anything radical. To me, there isn't that big a difference between XP and Windows 8, apart from the eye candy department. Same thing with Mac OS X. I've been using it since the preview beta and up through to Mavericks. And in all honesty, it still feels the same. And you know, we're talking a wide band of time. I'll give Windows 3.1 a small retro tick. DOS and from Microsoft. That's kind of retro. But I can't even really feel that 20-year-old NT 3.1 is retro. It's more retro than it is not, but it's still pretty much the same. Even when running XP on my office machine, I have it set back to the Windows 2000 look and feel. And it really, I can't tell the difference apart from the support and a few other bits and pieces, but... I suppose for me, XP is just something that all my applications run on. I don't really look at the operating system, be it Windows or the Mac OS X. To me, these days, I'm a applications guy rather than looking at the operating system. So, Carrington, what's your take on software and OSs having a different sort of retro scale to hardware?
I used to always say that for me, retro was anything 20 years old, but I used to just say it, and I often just say a lot of things, and I don't think I even meant it at the time, to be honest. So for me, retro very much is a personal thing, and I wonder if how much of this is just your age. Like if somebody was a lot younger than me and their first computing experience was XP, and that's what they think of as when you're a preteen, that's what a computer is, and they'll be nostalgic for that period if they'd feel very differently than me. But for me, it's hard to think of even a lot of things in the 90s as being retro. Like I'm an 80s and earlier. And is that because that was my formative years or is it just because that's different? I don't know. I draw a line in the sand a little bit in pre and post internet. So things that were pre-internet, I think of as being very old. And anything that's internet enabled and onward has just been iterations of the same thing. Paul mentioned that people will maybe be nostalgic for XP and go back just to play games. But I think you can't go back to, say, 2000 and onward games, because unless you're also going to set up Steam or something, everything, its DRM is talking back to servers, so they're not really standalone anymore. I can go back and play a game from the mid and early 90s or 80s or earlier. but it's increasingly tough to just go grab a disc of something from 1998 and run it, because it'll say, well, I'm trying to talk back to something and it's not there, so you can't run. So I don't know. Like, for me personally, I don't think I differentiate between OSs and other things. I think it's more that I lump everything, I would think, before XP even. I agree that Windows 3.1 would be one of the last operating systems that I would consider a retro-y type thing, because it was really just a veneer on top of DOS anyway. And I think early Mac stuff, System 7, maybe System 8, and earlier, it's hard to even think of System 9 as that retro, really. Like, so I don't know. For me, I think it needs to be, it's not just 20 years old. I think for my whole life, I'm going to say, nah, it's pre-1990, that's retro. And when I'm an old crotchety dude and nobody can really tell the difference between the 80s and 90s anymore, in the same way that right now when I think back to, say, the 1600s, what's the difference between 1620 and 1630? Whatever, it's all the same thing. Eventually, it's all going to be the same thing to the future as well, and us quibbling over the difference between, like, I see 1985 and 1992 as distinctly different periods, but there will be a point where it's all just, oh yes, that was pre-Wings and people only had the one head, and for me, it's 1980s or earlier is retro, and that's what I say now.
I think I'm in the Carrington camp.
That's a good camp to be in. Woohoo! Go Camp Carrington. We're going to get shirts.
Oh, I'll get the marshmallows.
And I'll get shirts for the marshmallows.
Earl, what do you think?
I agree that retro is in the eye of the beholder.
Oh, that's very philosophical.
It is. And the other thing is, the 70s and 80s were the birth of home computing. So while you may have some shifts and occasionally tectonic shifts in the computing paradigm, you're not ever going to have another birth of home computing. We're never going to have a first time again where we walked on the moon, for instance. So
I will personally have that.
That you might have that, but people won't have that. And the 70s and 80s were unique. So I think they're always going to represent a particularly unique kind of retro. Just like, you know, if you see a Model T driving down the street, or you see a Mustang from the 60s, or some other kind of muscle car, or maybe a 1950s Cadillac.
A Model T's a muscle car?
Yeah, no, the 60s. The 60s muscle cars, you know, the Mustangs. I had a Cougar. It was awesome. I love my 68 Cougar. But I'm just saying, if I see those driving down the road, I think, wow, that's pretty neat, especially if they're in nice restored condition. I'm wondering if a few decades from now, if somebody sees my 2001 Honda CR-V driving down the street, if they're going to go, oh my gosh, remember that? Remember the Honda CR-Vs?
They're going to say, I can't believe Earl is still driving that car.
I know. I know.
Spinning the wheels on the ice when it winter's over.
I live on a hill. It's horrible, actually, but that's another story. The feel for those things in the formative years of automobiles, the formative years of computers, I just think is always going to be different. Now, is XP retro? I mean, there's tons of people still running it. It did used to be in the official flame wars that they would have on the retro computing forums that 10 years was the rule of thumb. But I think that's kind of out the window. I think now it's become a lot more subjective. Mm-hmm. Flying XP doesn't feel retro to me. I will say 95 and the original versions of NT and that sort of thing, they're starting to feel kind of retro. You can light those up in a virtual machine and you can poke around with those and you can kind of remember the day when you ran servers on that stuff and you just wondered, wow, how did I ever do that? And so that's getting to be kind of a retro feel to me.
And to put it in context, like XP, like we're saying, it's been 12 years, but the Apple IIe, I think, was itself sold for 11 years. If Steve was here, he'd be able to tell us. But I think that was 83 to 94 or something like that. So that's not really that long a run.
Yeah.
Yeah. I agree that 95 is feeling kind of retro, though, like Windows 95.
Mm.
One of the things that I was thinking about also is just the kind of ubiquitous nature of all the stuff now as opposed to, you know, in the 80s and 90s. I mean, you were sort of rare to have computers at home and so forth in the mid 80s. Now, it's, you know, you have 17 computers just, you know, in your bedroom, and everybody has them, and it's unremarkable now. And I think that's part of it. It's just the scale has gotten so big that everything has kind of lost its remarkableness.
I totally agree with that.
It might be a bit case dependent on the thing and the context. Like computers, like Paul's saying, are ubiquitous and it's a big thing now. But if we focus on something in particular, like if you look at everyone's walking around nowadays with Android phones and iPhones, if you're rocking a Motorola StarTAC, then you're like a super retro hipster guy. Or even like a, what's that flat one that you used to have, the Razor. That's not that long ago, but somebody pulls out a Razor and you're, you know, neckbeard hipster guy. Like, that's super retro, and that's not that long ago. So maybe it does depend a bit on what it is. I can't believe you're wearing last year's Dockers, you know.
I think it's the birth of the device, right? Like, I've got a handspring visor, one of the original Palm-compatible kind of things. You pull out that monochrome thing that runs on AAA batteries, it's like, hello, caveman. You know, and it probably wouldn't even sync with a modern operating system. And that's not that long ago in actual years, but in terms of where it fits into today's ecosystem, it's totally prehistoric. So you see, that kind of fits into the theory that like the 70s and 80s, that was the time to be there for the home computer.
Yeah, it certainly was. As you said, Earl, I was packing up, moving. I found my Sharp IQ, I think they were called the Wizard over in North America, and also my Palm 3 and Palm 3C. Now, yeah, they're not really that old, but boy, do they feel retro in the hand. It really is, as you said, the device, the era, and where it came in that line. So, I think retro is more than 10 years old, is possibly, as a rule of thumb, is being well and truly hit with the hammer. So I think we'll have to go to the subjective view on that and let the flame wars continue on the retro forums. Okay, well, seeing we're talking about Microsoft XP, our friends at Microsoft have just announced that they are releasing the source for DOS and for Word for Windows, the first version. So this is hot on the heels of Apple releasing DOS, was it 3.2, through the Computer History Museum. Now, if you want to have a look at how DOS worked and how Word for Windows worked, we'll include the link to Microsoft's announcement and also the computerhistory.org so that you can have a look at the source for those. Interesting that Microsoft on their blog have actually said that it is for scholarly work. I think they're trying to say, don't rip us off or the £500 canary is going to come and do something to you.
That's a big canary.
Well, I don't really consider them a gorilla.
I do think that this is an exciting release. I was excited about the previous releases of stuff, like the Apple DOS one, and also, what was it, Mac Paint and Photoshop recently released. And I think these are important things and would be very easily lost to history. And companies never seem to want to let go of their source code, no matter how ancient something is, because I think they think maybe something bad could happen of it, and really what upside is there, so they just don't do it. So I love the fact that Microsoft has done this. I think MS-DOS, what have they released? I think 1.1 and 2 are two of the most important, at least two of the most affecting operating systems out there. It had massive long-term legacies that we're still living with. And Word for Windows, not a word processor I was a fan of, but had massive impact and eventually became like the big word processor.
Yeah, not the operating system of choice for me, and definitely I really do think that was a great idea of them to release Word for Windows.
Because, I'm now going to finally install it.
Yeah. From there, the whole Office Suite thing sort of exploded. So most people, when they're using their computer, are using an Office Suite, and really it started back at word processing. I know it started before Word for Windows, but again, Microsoft seized the initiative, and who has not heard of Word for Windows?
Mm-hmm.
And tip of the hat to the Computer History Museum for this work that they're doing. This is great stuff. Mm.
I don't know how they're getting these companies to release this stuff. Somebody there has just figured out the trick, because I'm sure this has been, they've desired this for ages, and somehow they're just getting everybody to cough up the goods.
Well, we should ask them. We should get those guys on the line, right?
My thoughts exactly.
Yeah, we should chat with the Computer History Museum. Maybe one of them would even come on the show if we ask them really nice.
They definitely are doing good work there. Yeah.
How could they resist?
They couldn't.
Okay, well, if you're interested in a little bit of source code history and you've just finished disassembling Apple DOS, well, now you can pop over and have a look at MS-DOS 1 and the original word for Windows. So, Carrington, what do you have to delight our news-deprived ears?
I have upcoming failure. I have something that I think is very cool, but I think is going to be a disastrous failure. But, you know, sometimes beautiful failures are still fun to look at. So there is an Indiegogo project out there. Indiegogo is kind of like Kickstarter, but they get your money even if they don't launch anything. That's how I think of Indiegogo. I'm sure they would prefer a different tagline. It's something called the Armiga project. And what it is a... an Amiga 500 redone. It's a hardware emulator. So it's a piece of hardware that will run as an Amiga 500, and it's based on an ARM chip, and that's why it's, I guess, called the Armiga. I don't see that this is going to be successful, only because they're looking to raise $140,000. And I think if this was on the market, it wouldn't have that much in sales. I don't think there's $140,000 worth of desire out there for this thing.
No, harsh but true.
I mean, I wish there was, but I just don't think it's going to happen. I think, however, it's a really neat project. So it's kind of too bad it's going to fail. The goal looks like if they were to put it together, it would cost €99 and up, depending on what you want, but the base unit's €100. Kind of pricey, but it gets powered by a dual-core ARM CPU, which should be far more than enough to emulate an Amiga 500. What's particularly neat about it is it's got Ethernet built in, it's got the HDMI out, so it's going to be an Amiga that's really easy to hook up to a modern television, and it's got an SD card slot, so you can use what are called ADFs, which I guess is the file disk format for... disk images for the Amiga. I'm not really an Amiga guy, so I don't know. And it's got two USB ports, so you plug in joysticks. They've built a custom joystick controller thing that they're supporting as well. And it really looks like a neat project. And there's a cool video, we'll link to it in the show notes, that shows the item in the second half of the video. Unfortunately, it's a couple of guys kind of talking blandly at the beginning. I think that's partly the reason why they've only raised a little over $8,000 of their $140,000 goal in the first week, I think, of it being up there. Got 52 days left as of today. I predict failure, but I wish I was wrong about that.
Also, there's another project that's actually quite a few years old now that is similar in nature, the Mini-MIG. Have you ever heard of that? It's Amiga 500 emulation using an FPGA board. And I don't know how much it would cost to get the FPGA board to actually do this emulation. I haven't looked into that. But this isn't the first time that someone has tried to do a hardware or firmware-oriented clone of the Amiga.
And that's one of the reasons I think that this, unfortunately, I'm predicting not success, is a modern computer... It's very easy to run software emulators. So if you just want access to playing Amiga stuff, you want to play Amiga games, you want to work on Amiga word processors, what have you, you can easily, very easily do that on your modern computer. If you don't want to run an emulation, I think most people want to do on actual hardware. And this is a middle ground where it's not going to be an original Amiga. It's just an emulator, but it's a 99-pound emulator that forces you to have another piece of hardware. So while it's a really cool item, I just think that that middle ground, there's not going to be enough desire for it to raise this kind of astronomical goal.
It'd be interesting to see. I mean, you're right that Amiga emulation is well-established. You've got even Cloanto, the company that does the Amiga Forever package, that has a complete setup that you buy their stuff and you get legally licensed for all the ROMs, which is kind of rare in the emulation community. And you get a nice emulation package that's auto-boot and some, you know, it's pretty turnkey in right. its operation.
I should mention that this does come with something called Kickstart 1.3. Not really sure what that is, but they seem to tout it as that will make this legal. So maybe that's the ROM collection or something. So it is going to legally be doing it, and that probably is adding to the cost.
Right. That is a ROM.
Well, you've decided to write my ROMs. Yeah, I went there. You can't keep me down.
I hasky.
Thank you.
Hasky.
Yeah, thank you, Punster.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Earl, I believe that you have been looking at some feedback that we've been receiving lately.
Yeah, just a very brief update. We asked people, what do you do with your vintage computers? Do they sit there on the shelf gathering dust, or, you know, do you take them in, to parties, show them to all your friends? And people responded, and I'm still getting responses, so I'm going to try and carve this into a host topic for one of our future shows. Maybe I'll take the next bit in the rotation. But I did want to let people know we've been receiving the feedback and enjoying it, and thank you. And not surprisingly, a lot of people use their retro computers for games. And I think that's pretty cool. And it gets the stuff out, and not only is it fun for us, but it's fun for the younger generation. I mean, what draws people in like a game, right? If they see a game, then that's eye-catching, and they come over, and then, you know, you can teach the kids about what it was like when dinosaurs roamed the earth. So, but I'll have a better report, and we'll make it a host topic in a future show. But thanks for the feedback and still coming in.
Okay. Well, speaking of hardware, there's always a good thing to have a new piece of hardware. And the next Brill thing has appeared out in the world. So Vince Brill has his new project, which he teased us about 12 months ago. But follow the links in the show notes, and you'll see prototype board number one, complete with keycaps, all the ICs, everything that you need, and it's the OSI Superboard 2. So, guys, did anyone use any of OSI's hardware back in the day?
No, but I loved the board, and particularly I love those iconic cases that you could get, you know, with the stepped down lower, almost like an Apple II sort of ish shape, but with the lower part for the keyboard on the Challenger things. And I loved them. And I think the Superboard 2, I could be totally wrong, but wasn't it the first, like, full computer on a board that was, like, you know, had everything, had the keyboard and the cassette thing and all of that? Like, just here's your full computer totally assembled. Pretty sure that was the case.
I think it was, but there's plenty of information out there. Yeah. So folks, when you click on the link to have a look at this, make sure you go back to the beginning of this thread in Vince's forum, and you'll see his breadboarded prototypes with the micro switches for the keyboards. And on the back, there's just a lovely, lovely spider's web of wire wrap connections. Very interesting seeing the evolution of a piece of hardware emulation. Vince has some wonderful products, so you can also pop over to his store and see what he's got. But good to see that another computer is coming out as the Brill thing.
But gang, but I have to ask the esteemed panel. There's a qualitative difference here, and I feel it, but I don't exactly understand it. So we just talked about the Amiga clone project, and I agree with Carrington that, you know, I cross my finger for these folks on their Indiegogo project, but I don't know if it's going to make it across the finish line. And that's because it's that middle ground that Carrington was talking about. It's not really the original, but it's not an emulation. It's kind of an in-betweener. Also, the Brill projects, don't they fit in that same category?
Yeah, but where are you going to grab an Ohio Scientific computer? Like, Amigas are dime a dozen.
Is it like, hey now!
back in your corners, pal, boys, back in the corners.
They go for some serious, what's the word, Michael? Dosh? Is that the...
is that what you're calling it nowadays?
Is that the European slang for money? I can't remember what.
I wouldn't have a clue. I'm in Australia.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Why Commonwealth? Come on, you guys are all You know your slang.
I'm drinking tea.
So, is that the difference? Because it's an Apple One replica, and, you know, you're not exactly going to go buy an Apple One. Or it's a Kim, and, you know, those go for a lot of money. Or it's an Ohio Scientific, and, yeah, you're going to pay serious bucks for those.
That's, and also, where are you going to get
Whereas
them?
Whereas an Amiga, you could get, you know, $150, $200 probably.
The thing is, I don't think that Amiga project is going to fail because there's no desire for it. I think they're saying they need $140,000 to get off the ground and launch this thing. And I don't think it will have enough sales, even if they said it's done and it's out and we're selling it for $100 a pop or whatever, 100 euros, say $150 US. They're not going to sell 1,000 of them. There just isn't enough market for that as a starting point. Breel isn't saying that. He's not saying I gotta raise a couple $100,000 to get going. He just puts it together, says, I've got my kit, and I'm going to sell what I'm going to sell.
Yeah, I think Vince has basically proven that he can take basically benchmark computers from our history and produce a work-alike. And I think that's the big difference to me, is he's producing a work-alike. It's not a replica. It doesn't look exactly like the original Apple One when you use the Vince's kit, the motherboard for the OSI Superboard. It's not the same, but it's got that beautiful single-board feel, and I am lusting after that keyboard. It just says, buy me. It screams at buy me.
And but is he going to sell 1,000 of them? I don't think so. I mean, I think it's amazing, but I just don't think there's a big enough market that if he said, I need $140,000 or I'm not making the first one, then we would never see it. I like his approach better. I do agree, though. I look at this thing and I want it so badly.
Well, there you are. Vince only has to sell another 998, doesn't he?
Yep.
One for Carrington, one for me, and the rest of the planet.
It's amazing to look at it, though. And speaking of evolution, when you look at this and how few ICs there are, like the keyboard is almost over half of the size of it. And if you go look at the original Superboard, it's, you know, a full-on motherboard with all this stuff. It'd be amazing to take this back in time and show it to the Ohio Scientific people saying, I've slightly improved on your design. They'd be like, how'd you do this magic?
Yeah, I have wazzed your board.
Totally. Yes, Vince has completely wazzed their board, yes. Looks great. It looks so good. The red color, all of it, just looks amazing.
Yeah. He said that red is probably not going to be the production color, but I want red. Mm-hmm. I want the red one.
We should lobby him, because yes. I like that red board too. And what is it about that keyboard? Everybody was commenting on that too. I don't know if it was in the forum or wherever I saw this posted. Everybody was saying, I just love that keyboard. It looks so...
Well, isn't
retro.
It more that we've all grown up on the MicroSwitch full movement keyboards and just that style, just right down to the fonts and the size of the letters, everything on the keyboard to me just harkens back to my first days programming. It's just got that lust, that desire for it.
Also, to the left of the A is a control key, not a caps lock, a useless caps lock near my pinky. So I prefer that too.
My favorite is the brake key. Oops, I didn't mean to press that. I meant to press return.
But at least it's off way over to the side, so that's good. But it is, dangerously near the return key. I like the rub out key.
I think management took that key off the keyboard because they were tired of us taking breaks.
Could be. Press every key to continue.
I used to take work breaks between my coffees anyway, so...
But they left the escape key, so I can still escape.
Yeah, run away. Well, thank you, Vince, for bringing another beautiful board out there, and I will definitely have to have a look at my pocket money and have a look at getting one of those. Okay, so, Carrington, I see that you've been playing with your Pi again.
Well, I haven't, but a fellow named Tony... has, Tony Matress, I think it is. And so this is the point of the show that I become a big hypocrite. So first I bring up a kit thing saying no one's going to buy it, never going to fly, whatever. And here we're going to go back and now let's have a different thing. So instead of, we have a Raspberry Pi just in a case. And I think this thing is gorgeous. And it's not really something for sale. It's just, but it's the exact sort of, you know, maker approach that I just admire so much. So somebody has taken a Raspberry Pi and put it inside a little case. And the case that they selected is where the glory here is. It's this old teletype machine. It's a what the heck is this? I can't even remember, but it's this gorgeous, like, talk about a gorgeous keyboard. I love this thing. And so it's an Ultratech teletype machine. That's it. I got it for $1.50 at a thrift store. It's amazing and beautiful. So it's just a gorgeous keyboard in the front, and then an acoustic coupler up top looking like little Mickey Mouse ears. And he's decided, I'm going to make that a Raspberry Pi case, went inside, wired everything up, wired up to that keyboard, and basically just turned it into a keyboard you can use. But it's just shockingly beautiful. I saw this thing and I immediately started lusting after it. And I thought it was the kind of little, you know, maker project that our listeners, our audience, would also really enjoy looking at. This teletype itself is just stunning, and I need to have it. I want to go to there.
Just the Raspberry Pi, they're such handy little devices, and I think we're going to be seeing more Pis in custom cases. And really, I think for the steampunk fraternity out there, the Raspberry Pi will definitely turn up into some of their creations.
But I would rather be using this keyboard than the keyboard I'm using at the moment. Like, this just as a keyboard thrills me.
Well, we'd have to mute you out with a keyboard like that. You would drown us all out.
It's worth it. It's so worth it.
Yeah. Well, and if you have a keyboard of this sort, no one will expect you to write JavaScript or anything like that, because you have no option to use half the keys you need.
No one expects me to write JavaScript now. They see my angry face when they ask.
Don't get me started on JavaScript. Okay. Well, going from a Raspberry Pi inside a teletype machine. Oh, Earl, is that you with your hand up at the back of the class? Earl.
It is. I was being, too discreet. So somebody did a comparable project. They took a VT100, which has a well-defined interface port, like a expansion slot, and they stuck a beagle bone in it. They made an add-on card. I just thought it was kind of interesting. It was like a spiritual cousin to what Carrington was just talking about. So I'll put a link for that up in the show notes too. A BeagleBone is a comparable device to a Raspberry Pi. It's a low-cost, Linux-running, ARM-based little single-board computer. And I think it's probably been around longer than the Raspberry Pi. It just doesn't have the market exposure. Yeah, exactly. But this is really fun because you take the computer and stick it inside the VT100. You turn your VT100 into a computer. So I love what this guy's done. People should take a look at. That's all.
I agree. Very cool looking.
And maybe while we're here in this break, I will steal the spare news about the Nano VIC-20 as well. Just sort of in the same theme of modern microcontrollers. This is someone who has taken it's an Arduino, I guess, and created a VIC-20 on it, which is a bit of a challenge just because they're modern and they're faster than things from the 80s, but they're really small. You know, they're
very small.
They're physically small, but they also don't have a lot of space, meaning memory, is what I'm trying to say. So this person put a VIC-20 on a Nano, which is I don't even know what to compare it with size wise. You can see a picture. If you look at a picture of it, there's a USB port on it, and it's probably about it's like two USB ports wide and something like five USB ports long. It's almost like a chip size.
Yeah, it's basically
about
the size
of a 40 pin dip chip would be about the same size, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it looks like it. Anyway, there's some discussion of what it took to get all of the VIC-20 onto this little microcroller.
The amount of user space that's left in there is just tens of bytes.
Yeah. Was this so there was a comment on this that this was, when was this done? It looks like the post actually wasn't all that long ago. February.
So a little bit older than that, but that was just one of the recent posts to it. But yeah, it's another example of just using lovely micro size modern technology, and it still is fairly modern, to just to do something different. I just love it. So bring on the hardware.
Yeah,
and you can get one of the Arduino Nanos for about $10. So basically, you've got, now they did say in the article that they didn't implement everything that the VIC-20 has. I guess they didn't have the pixel graphics and some of the other things. And you actually start out with a little less RAM than you did with the VIC-20. But this is an amazing achievement. Like Paul's saying, there's just not a lot of room on these 18 mega chips. So what they did with this is just, is it even an 18 mega? I think it is.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Nano runs an 18 mega. Yeah. Yeah, it's beautiful. So $10, and you could do this. $10 and a couple of discrete components to hook it up to video.
And in fact, actually, I think this is like very too timely news. But yesterday was Arduino Day. I forget who it was, but somebody was because it was the anniversary of something, or there was some sort of thing where they were selling Arduinos very cheap, like half price or something. But anyway. Whatever. Kind of pointless. It's over now. But even cheaper than $10 they were yesterday. And I missed it.
Ah. Well, you could have got
your stuff
at Adafruit for 10% off yesterday because of Arduino Day. But
and Michael's in Australia, and nobody ever knows what time or day it is there. So can't he just buy it?
Well,
like, all times exist in Australia.
No, well, it's already tomorrow over here, guys.
That's what you say. But for all I know, you scroll over and it's last Wednesday. Australians, man.
The quiet achievers.
Okay, so now we can get back to the little Richard Garriott thing that I almost launched into before. This isn't really very much news, but so people who aren't familiar with who Richard Garriott is, he went by Lord British and created the Ultima series. So these are the games. These games were ported on to many different computers, and you know they continued. I don't know.
There was only one worth playing on, though.
Right, exactly.
So the Commodore. I
yeah,
know what you mean.
Whatever. Yeah.
But so this this all sort of started off when he was, I think he was in high school and maybe even younger, and wrote this game called Calibeth in BASIC.
It's pronounced Karateka.
I see. Exactly. Yes. I think I have a GIF of it
isn't
here.
Isn't it Karateka, Beth?
Oh, that's it. Who knows? All games are pronounced that way.
But, at any rate, so what I think is really cool, and I think, so probably maybe 3-4 episodes ago or something, I had also brought up Lord British before when he was giving some kind of a tour of his office and showing people some stuff. But he's one of the things that I think is kind of just interesting is that he's still, although he does all kinds of stuff with like space programs and things like this, and he's working with a new, you know, sort of VR type game, you know, first person mover, at least I guess sword wielder. But he still is very into the world of you know 1980. So he posted something on Twitter, which is just a picture of his computer. This is, I think it's an Apple. It is a his 2+ with the original Calibeth disk, which of course on the open market is very, very expensive. But of course he has the original copy, and he just sort of posted this as a thing. Whenever this happens, there's a little bit of discussion that follows that. And he's actually really, interactive. But, so in that exchange that happened after that, someone named James Tauber had put together a little Python script which would take the code. So it's the whole thing is written in BASIC, which is a kind of a on the Apple it's tokenized. So it's when it's stored on the disk, each individual command is represented in a single byte. So it's not trivial to get the you know, sort of the BASIC back out, unless you have a way to map it. And so James Tauber went and wrote a little Python script to extract the Calibeth source code because he wanted to see it. There was a little discussion on Twitter that, you know, somebody said, I'd like to see the source code, and Richard Garriott said, well, I'll see if I can find it. And, of course, it's there. It's I mean, the thing is written in BASIC, and it's right there on the disk, which was, you know, deprotected by pirates long ago. And, you know, so with this detokenized thing, you can take a look at it. And one of the things that's just kind of interesting about it is, you know, you look at it, the detokenized file, and it's, I don't know, you're scrolling, and it's maybe like 9 pages worth, and that's it. It's over. You know, I mean, it's actually not
it's
a very
not
big
that
program.
Much, and it's not that complicated.
No, but it still had a big effect at the time.
I've spent hours and hours playing that game when I was supposed to be doing something else up in the university computer lab. So,
I've actually never played it, but now that I have the source code, I think I might paste it into something and go play, because it's exciting.
There's a magazine that was, it was primarily devoted to enabling you to make backup copies of your protected disks, the Computist, or I think before that it was called Hardcore Computist. Mm-hmm. But one, I think one of the, it may have been even in the very first issue, but at least very early on, they had a sort of a discussion of how you can copy the Akalabeth disk, and they also in there included some bug fixes, which I thought was kind of neat. They because once you can copy it, you can actually get at the source and, you know, add a teleport and things like this.
You break it and fix it.
Right.
I like how people were commenting on his Twitter post with the picture of the discs. He specifically says he's playing on the master copy of the game, and a lot of people post, shouldn't you make a backup or play something instead? Like, what if the disc just like gets eaten? But okay, living dangerously.
Yeah, it's mine, and I can do what I like with it.
Yep. He is a lord, after all.
He is. He's British.
Yes. All British people are lords. Isn't that how it works? It's like redundant.
I brought along my son Jonathan, who in the year 2001 will be the same age as I am now. Maybe he will be better adjusted to this kind of world that you're trying to portray.
The big difference when he grows up, in fact, if we wanted to wait for the year 2001, is that he will have in his own house, not a computer as big as this, but at least a console through which he can talk to his friendly local computer and get all the information he needs for his everyday life, like his bank statements, his theater reservations, all the information you need in the course of living in a complex modern society. This will be in a compact form in his own house. He'll have a television screen like these here, and a keyboard, and he'll talk to the computer, get information from it, and he'll take it as much for granted as we take the telephone.
I wonder, though, what sort of a life would it be like in social terms? I mean, if our whole life is built around the computer, do we become a computer-dependent society and a computer-independent individuals?
In some ways, but they'll also enrich our society, because it'll make it possible for us to live really anywhere we like. Any businessman, any executive, could live almost anywhere on Earth and still do his business through a device like this. And this is a wonderful thing. It means we want him to be stuck in cities, we better live out in the country or wherever we please, and still carry on complete interaction with human beings as well as with other computers.
Okay, well, I think that's it for the news today. So it's my turn to make a suggestion of what you wonderful gentlemen could get me. Well, everyone needs a good set of Jim Jams. So over at our favorite Think Geek website, there is a product there currently on special. It is Star Trek pajamas. It comes in the standard colors. You've got your blue, you've got your gold. And for that someone special in your life, you can even get them the red.
That means they're someone temporary in your life. I'm afraid I can't commit. You're going to have to wear the red ones.
Step outside and show the audience how the monster works. But as much as being a Star Trek original series fan, I don't think I could quite bring myself to getting the red pair just for that short guest role feel it has about it. Mind you, they also have the Star Trek Next Generation in pajamas there as well, and I think the red is a lot more striking and something I'd go for. But not only can you get yourself a pair of Star Trek pajamas with zip-in booties, it's on special, so Currently, it's $19.99 plus delivery. So,
My feet are always cold these days, so I think I got to get a pair of these.
Pair of footy pajamas for Earl.
Yeah, exactly. I work at home. I'll be sitting around my Star Trek, you know, doing IT stuff. Who knew?
That's what the kids are calling it these days, right?
Right.
Next time Earl's working from home, folks, just make sure you got video turned off.
Yeah, you definitely want to.
I was just going through ThinkGeek, and I was in a bit of a Star Trek peace of mind, and accidentally clicked on the pajamas, slippers, and robes section. I was actually looking for a jacket, and that came up, and I thought, ah.
And your eBay auction.
Well, my eBay. Let's launch into eBay. So again, this is something I came across while packing up my computer bits and pieces, moving house. I'll tell you that downstairs room is taking a lot longer to pack and move than what I thought. I just keep going into reminiscing mode. So what I have here for my eBay pick is Star Trek: The Kobayashi Alternative. It's quite reasonably priced. I can't say it was one of my favorite games. I must admit the hardcover presentation I quite enjoyed. I think that might have been why I picked it up. Like a lot of my games, these are games I've picked up the original discs and manuals and whatnot for many years after first playing them. I think my university budget didn't quite stretch to buying these things off the shelf. But then again, 1985, yeah, I was finished university by then anyway, and I had other excuses for not buying stuff. So here we have here for the Commodore 64, a fairly good quality game. So $15.99, buy it now, and add a little bit of Trek to your game shelf.
Yeah, I think this is the second, actually. I think there were two of these, and I'm forgetting the name of the first one.
Yeah, I've got them both for the Apple II.
Yeah, I have. Well, actually, as it happens, so do I. But I still can't remember the name of it. But anyway, it is kind of neat how there's an actual, you know, book. It really does present like a hardcover book, except it has a disc in it, and the labels all fall off because they're old.
Well, mind the labels are managing to hold on. I try not to stare at them too hard. Right. So Carrington, what have you got to entice us on the wonderful world of eBay?
Well, I am going to shock everybody by selecting an Apple II item. And what I've selected is a controller. At the time, it had no bids. Now it's got one. So I was hoping that somebody could snag it for nothing. But alas, no. It is a flight yoke, and it's fun to say yoke. So it is basically a little steering wheel, a flight steering wheel that you can plug into your Apple II while you're doing your flight simulator stuff. I was never a huge fan of flight simulators, but everybody else seemed to love them. So I thought for those of you who do love them, then this might add a bit of extra realism when you go all retro and play those games. So it's the Max Control Yoke for the Apple II. And I've never used it, but it comes in a box, and they're only asking $9, or $10, rather. And alas, somebody else has bid. So, but I like the little shooty buttons on the top of the stick, so it looks like a fun controller to play with. So this is my selection, a flying joystick thingy for the Apple II.
I kind of wonder if that would... I assume, just because the Apple II is a fairly simple machine, that this is probably just a joystick with a funny shape. I mean, like, you could presumably use this to play, Pac-Man.
Yeah, because even joysticks are really just paddle things on the Apple II. They're just, you know, emulating the two paddles.
All right. In the one piece of hardware, yeah. Flight simulators were just something I never really got interested in. I just sort of found them quite tedious, and I just wanted to get into dominating the galaxy and exterminating aliens and other essentials.
Okay,
well, Earl, I gather you don't have something that's Apple-flavored to talk about.
I don't. This is something that I want and have wanted for, I guess, years now, and I completely don't understand why I want this. I see almost no utility to it whatsoever, but I just really love it. It is a outboard numeric keypad that can plug into, it's an Atari brand unit, the CX85. They say it's also for Commodore. I've never seen anybody plug one of these into a Commodore. I have seen one or two for the Atari throughout the years. The eBay auction lister says that they retailed for $124. And unless you are a hardcore VisiCalc accountant, I just can't see you laying down $124 bucks for one of these things. But it's just a numeric keypad that also has a few extra keys like escape. It has yes and no, which I suppose could be handy if you're playing Magic 8 Ball on your Atari. And why do I want this? Guys, help me out. I can't tell you why I want it.
Because you want to have it on your desk and you're going to be like a James Bond villain and like your hand hovers over the yes, the delete, the no button. You've got escape just in case.
No.
You're petting your cat with the one hand and your minion comes in and asks you a question. You reach over, delete. It just opens up a trapdoor. That's exactly what you want, girl.
You just want the bridge to be retracted so that the hero falls into the pool of sharks.
Yes, lasers. We meet again, Mr. Bond. But this time, I have my CX-85. Yeah, I tell you, I have no idea why. Maybe, again, it's that sort of visceral feeling that we have for keyboards. It's just, you know, they're just this physical kind of device thing. And this one looks really cool, too. I always thought it looked cool. Maybe that's why I want it.
There's a few sellers with them online at the moment. I like the one you've selected because this person is in Milton, Ontario, which is a short drive from Toronto and offers free shipping, at least to me. So, nice choice.
It's free shipping to me as well, and $19 for brand new in the box didn't seem like a bad deal. So that's my pick.
Yeah, that looks. I really actually kind of like this Atari color scheme that went, you know, with the peripherals of this era. There are disk drives and some other mm-hmm. things that have that look the same.
The CX85 cool. seems styled like a 810 drive and like the Atari 800 mm-hmm. 400.
I was going to ask, would this match the 800, the Atari I still dream of getting?
It does. This matches that particular color scheme. It's not the later, like the 800, you know, the later.
The XL and stuff? Yeah, I didn't like those. This is very pretty. I like the form factor here. I like this color scheme. I like, in general, this line of Atari stuff for its industrial design. I like it very much.
Okay, Paul, many TI 99 4A things. Please
yes.
fill me in.
So my pick here is not an actual item, but a seller, which in fact I am not too happy about doing that. And in some respects, no sponsorship is implied here, but or involved. But the apparently what has happened is that this person has found a huge stockpile of old TI-99-4A stuff. I think it was a whole... I don't know what the backstory is. He actually also found what appeared to be a huge sort of stock of 3M discs as well. He had for quite a long time. Pretty much anything 3M ever made, as far as I could tell, in large boxes. But so he seems to have a whole bunch of just sort of new... stuff for the TI-99-4A, and one of the things that sort of caught my attention was the expansion box. So I don't know if you remember the way the 99-4A was set up, but it's actually, you know, it's a relatively small little, I would say, MacBook Pro sized you know, keyboard thing, and on that you could play games and so forth. But if you wanted to expand it, it had a little bay on the side, and you could stick a little sidecar thing on there. And there's actually a very funny picture somewhere that gets posted around occasionally with a TI-99-4A with all of the peripherals stuck in, because they all stick in this sort of sidecar way. And, you know, it's like, I don't know, 4.5 feet long or something, with disk drives and modems, and it's very, very funny. But what you could do apart from that was to get an expansion box, a peripheral expansion box, which is... that's, you know, big, huge desktop computer-sized thing that you stick sort of behind your TI-99-4A and connect it. And then into that you can put disk drives and so forth. And so he's got, this seller has got new ones, you know, in the box, in the foam, still, you know, with the manuals, everything. It really, it's pretty amazing, and these things are huge, so he's just trying to get rid of them. I mean, they are, it's not super cheap. You know, he's right now he's selling them for $100. Buy it now, and it does not have a disk drive in it. You can get from him separately the disk drive that goes in it, also new in its box. But so
but wait
not,
a minute,
$100
for a new peripheral expansion box?
Yeah, right. And
that,
and that's actually a
decent price.
Decent as in something to go for, I think.
Yeah, it says there are more than 10 available, and the comments in the thing, in the auction say, these things are taking up too much space. I need to get rid of them. But it's
sounds you know, like he's been told.
Yeah, when you see like before this, when you saw these peripheral expansion boxes, they are. I mean, you know, they're all beat up. Nothing. You know, some of the cards are broken, and they're very heavy to ship, and they're still very expensive, more than this. Usually, so this is anyway. I thought it was really neat. It's worth, particularly if you're into the TI-99/4A world. Take a look at what he has listed here, because it does appear like a vault of you know, old dealer stock has become available and isn't too crazy expensive. So
nice catch, Paul.
Yep. Thanks.
Yeah. So just to, you know, remind TI people that, well, they probably already know this, but anyone who's thinking of getting into that world, so the way to do it old school would be to have one of those peripheral expansion boxes and some of the full height disk drives that you stick in there and the memory upgrade and that kind of thing. If you want to go a different route, there are some modern day add-ons that will take you into the TI world, but will be more modern in terms of their approach. Like the NanoPeb is a peripheral expansion box, but it's teeny tiny. And the Compact Flash 7 Plus, maybe we can get this link into the show notes. But with the NanoPeb, you've got 32K RAM, emulation of 3 floppy drives, a couple gigabytes of compact flash possible, et cetera, et cetera. So you've got a lot of the peripheral expansion box functionality, but in this tiny little card.
One of the things I have to admit, I have a NanoPeb and I have yet to plug it in, but one of the things that it doesn't do is actually allow you to connect a disk drive. You know, like I was looking at some of these things that had 5 1/4 inch floppy disks and thinking, well, okay, how can I use those? And I can't. You know, I have to buy a peripheral expansion box and a disk drive in order to actually use them. It would be kind of neat if there was some way, you know, something that could be done that isn't, you know, entire peripheral expansion box size but as far as I know,
can you not put disk images on the NanoPeb?
Oh yes, you can. Yes, so it will emulate a disk drive on a compact flash card. But if you actually are holding a 5 1/4 inch disk, you will just continue to hold it.
No way to do it. Gotcha.
Oh well, that sounds like we've. Definitely got Paul going down the slippery slope of the TI-99/4A.
I found that photo of the TI with the many expansions plugged in fading off to the right, so I've put that in the show notes as well. So if our listeners want to see a fully expanded kind of, here's my computer and the rest of the office is just expansions, you can take a look at the fully expanded.
I think that picture's going into my wallpaper.
Yeah, looks awesome, so actually. It looks like, why aren't you plugging stuff in on the other side? Like it just, and look how far the disk drives at the end of the chain look like they're about 6 feet from the computer. Like, you must never want to swap disks.
But I'm left-handed. I have to reach over. Okay. Well, all well and good. So have we anything else that you just want to throw in here at the end? Carrington, I see that you are about to be a busy boy, or are you saying someone else is about to be a busy boy?
I'm way too lazy to be a busy boy. This is all about other people. So a couple of bits of notes that weren't really computer related, so I thought I'd shut them off to the end, but one has to do with the Internet Archive. There's a lady named Marion Stokes, and for many, many years, she recorded television news and local television talk shows. She has 40,000 tapes, a mix of VHS and Betamax tapes. They are now in the hands of the Internet Archive, and they want to digitize them and put them online. So people who are interested in, you know, this, the archiving of information and the saving of things like that, which is sort of quasi-related to computers and the stuff that the Internet Archive does. I thought this might be of interest to our listeners, so I'll have a link to that in the show notes. It's going to take a long time and a lot of money and many, many hours of work to because you can't just digitize the tapes, and that's a slow process. You also have to enter all the metadata, etc., to make it a proper archive. But crazy large amounts of just like full-on recordings to get the actual unedited broadcasts with the commercials and all of that. And
I was going to say, with the commercials in there, that's quite a trove of...
I wish the commercials were in on everything nowadays. Well, I don't like commercials in modern stuff, and ads just in general drive me crazy. If I put in, like, say, a DVD of, say, TV from the 80s, I'd actually prefer to have a quick commercial break with a single commercial that would be applicable for the date that the original show aired. I think that would add a lot to it. But anyway, I was very interested in the story, and I thought a lot of our listeners might be interested as well, so I'll have a link to that in the show notes. And also, I mentioned on a couple of episodes ago, the 30th anniversary edition of the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy text adventure game would be going up for free on the BBC Radio 4 site. It is now live, so those of you who want to play it, you can check it out. They've sort of skinned it with a neat-looking, quote-unquote neat-looking metallic skin, but it is now available online for free, and it's been a little tweaked, and the nice thing is you don't just get the text adventure. Off in the right, you get the little images that are in keeping with the way they were drawn, that sort of vibrant line drawings from the television show. So if you're a fan of the original Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy TV show and that art style, then they've added that back to the game, which is a real treat, I think. So we'll have a link to that in the show notes for those who want to check out a game that's billed as, "This game will kill you frequently." It's a bit mean like that. So if that interests you, then that is available online for free.
Earl, have you got anything final words?
Yeah, my parting shots. So in the tradition of amateur podcasters, I'm going to overcommit and underdeliver. And so the RetroBits family of podcasts, if things go the way I like, April's going to be an exciting and fun month. So I just want to throw that out there and let people know that I haven't forgotten about those podcasts, and April should be interesting. So tune in. That's all I'm going to say.
I'm already subscribed to everything you do. Give me more shows.
That's my goal.
Woohoo!
Well, that's good news. Excellent. Paul, any parting shots?
Well, not so much to say about things I'm going to do, but just a couple of comments about the previous things. Marion Stokes also, apart from this like 40,000 VHS collection, also had a huge storage space of basically just, it seems like, you know, all of the Apple products in their boxes. She had saved a bunch of these things. And the Retro Maccast podcast interviewed, I think, what is his name? Henry Plain, who took possession of this after she passed away. And it's really quite something. It's always sort of interesting to see these things in their kind of original condition, because what's funny about it, of course, we're all familiar with this, is that, you know, at the time, you get the computer, you know, and it becomes obsolete. You know, the box is in the way, you throw it away, you know, whatever, you spill coffee on the manual. It doesn't, nothing seems like particularly very important at the moment, but it is really interesting to be able to see these things more or less as they would have come out of the store. So this is, you know, a huge storage. We can put a link in there somewhere, but there's Cult of Mac had a story with some pictures in it. I guess that was it. Oh, yes, the other thing I was going to say about Hitchhiker's Guide was that what actually is kind of cool about it is that once you die, it lets you continue to give it commands.
Nice.
So it just tells you, you know, you're awfully talkative for a dead person.
That's Infocom kind of humor right there.
Yeah.
Hey, is it possible that the person with these VHS tapes was a little bit of a hoarder?
No.
I mean, just saying.
40,000 no. tapes, that's...
You could build, my goodness.
You could build a house out of that.
I bet the network doesn't have 40,000 tapes.
Well, I'm sure the networks actually would be interested in the content of that, because I think that a lot of that material would not have been kept in their archives.
Mm-hmm.
And especially right. the ads, a lot of that ad material definitely wouldn't have been kept, and that itself would be a great little snapshot of those days that have gone by.
Especially because it was a lot of local stuff and local mm. news programs, which probably very few people were recording, so it's much less likely that there are other copies of that. A lot of famous people appeared on them, so yeah, so it's fantastic that she kept mm. them all, but it's a lot of work to digitize it, no doubt.
Oh, it is. I've been digitizing VHS and I did do some Betamax tapes until the machine died. Family videos, home videos that are on tape, and we're just getting all that onto digital files. So yes, it's a lot of hard work to get that, and especially if some of those are N generation tapes that were used. So hopefully they were all recorded to new. Well, also. For me, parting shots, the 8-bit bunker downstairs is moving along. I've got 8 bookcases packed up, 5 are in downstairs, but this packing and reminiscing is really slowing things down, but we'll get there. But one thing, and Earl's promised to possibly help out here, but my commute is now an hour each way, and I am rapidly running out of podcasts to listen to. So if our listeners have any suggestions of non-tech podcasts that they would think might be interesting, just drop us a line with a few suggestions. I really want to avoid listening to the radio on my drives home and to work, so I'd be interested to see. To hear what our listeners listen to.
I'd be interested in that too. I'm always looking for new podcasts myself.
Well, everybody, that looks like that's it for this show. You can find the notes for this podcast and all our others at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss us at vintage-computer.com/VCforum. You can follow us on Twitter at rcrpodcast. And send feedback and podcast suggestions and what do you do with your retro computers to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are also a member of the Throwback Network, and there will be a link to the Throwback Network. And please, if you do download us off iTunes, come back and give us a rating and a review. That'll help other retro enthusiasts find our podcast. So, everybody, until next time...
Retro Compute!